Hello everyone. It is 12:15. It looks like our numbers are still going up, but we'll go ahead and get started anyways. I am Megan Phillips and I am the co-director of ICFRC and your host for today's program. Good afternoon everyone. Thank you for joining us. Today we have a presentation by Chad Hart, who is the Associate Professor of Economics from Iowa State University, who is going to speak to us today on COVID-19 and global agriculture. I want to acknowledge our university and community supporters, the UI International Programs, the UI Honors Program, the UI Public Policy Center, and the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. We also thank City Channel 4 for making our programs viewable to online audiences. And our format today is the normal one, or at least the new normal. Following our speaker's presentation at about 1 p.m., we will have 15 minutes of a Q&A session, and you can submit your questions via chat through Zoom, or if you're watching on Facebook, you can also submit them in the comments. And with that, it's my pleasure to introduce today Chad Hart. Chad Hart is an extension economist and associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. He is a native of Southwest Missouri, growing up on a rural homestead near Stark City, Missouri. He received his PhD in economics and statistics in 1999 from Iowa State University. His work has concentrated on crop marketing, crop insurance, international trade agreements, and bioenergy policy. Chad is also a partner in FarmRisk, an Iowa firm that develops revenue insurance products for agriculture. Please join me in welcoming Chad Hart.
It's my pleasure to be with you all today.
Great. Let me stop screen sharing here and I will hand it over to you.
All righty. And then I guess I'll take over screen sharing.
Absolutely.
As it usually goes. All right. So now hopefully you see my screen.
Yep. Looks good.
All right. Well, it's my pleasure to be with you today. Since Megan already introduced me, I'll just jump right into it. So as we're looking at the global agricultural situation and how COVID-19 has impacted it, I thought the World Bank actually put out a recent piece that did a very good job of summarizing how global agricultural markets are handling themselves. And I'll let you read the quote itself, but the punchline was basically this, that we found that the agricultural markets actually held up better than the overall general economy in most cases, that we find production levels for many agricultural products are holding at record to near record levels. So we continue to see very strong production within our agricultural markets. And we continue to see those agricultural products moving throughout the globe. When I'm looking at trade data thus far in agriculture, throughout the pandemic, trade has remained very strong, very vibrant. And so we're seeing, I would argue, good to excellent global food supplies. And we've had a few export and import restrictions being put on by individual countries. But as the World Bank says, sort of in the second paragraph on this slide, there really isn't a need for those restrictions because supplies are ample and we are able to move the product as we're moving forward. Now, this is not to say that ag is completely held harmless from COVID-19. We did see some struggles definitely earlier this year. Ag has weathered the first wave of COVID-19, and there are some longer term challenges that we are definitely concerned about within agriculture as we look at COVID-19. But at least here, as we enter the fall of 2020, the idea is that things are in a good spot in terms of being able to manage alongside this pandemic, at least right now. And I'll show some data here in a few minutes to sort of back up what the World Bank sort of summarized here. Those challenges, though, that we're facing are really concerns looking forward here, and I'll really jump to the middle of this paragraph. Probably the biggest concern we have in terms of global agriculture is not within the production side of the market. It's more about how consumption will hold up, and especially the loss of income that we're seeing globally and how that may create some tension, especially in places where we do see some price inflation. At the very end of this paragraph, the World Bank notes that despite stable global food prices, that we do see some countries where we are experiencing price inflation, especially at the retail level. And as we struggle with employment in some countries, income levels in some countries, that combination of lower income with some higher food prices out there is straining the nutritional budgets for families out there. And it's an issue that we are worried that will build as we move forward over the next year or two, as the pandemic remains in play throughout the globe. Now, as far as the disruptions to domestic food supply, we did see those earlier this year, even here in the U.S., as was mentioned in one of the polling questions that was scrolling through the screen just before the meeting. The idea is we did see at our meat processing plants, those disruptions happened. It wasn't just in the meat sector where we saw that. We also saw it in some of the packaging for some of our fruits and vegetables. And that wasn't a phenomenon just here in the U.S. We did see that in other countries as well. And so that is another concern as we're looking forward here, is that we could see another wave of disruptions there. But like I say, I think the biggest thing right now is the concern on the consumer side, because it's not only a worry about the income levels dropping, but we're also concerned with how households will shift their food consumption. And especially here in the U.S., that was arguably the biggest challenge we faced this year with COVID-19. As the pandemic wrapped its way around the globe and, you know, truly finally impacted the U.S. here in the spring of 2020, we saw the government responses, the stay-at-home orders, the shelter-in-place orders, the need to shut down certain businesses. And especially when you think about it, the big key for our food industry would be the restaurants and the school districts. What that did was it forced a lot of food consumption that had been away from the home suddenly back into the home place. And when we look at food data, what we find, you know, is always the case here, is that people consume differently outside the home than they do inside the home. And so that meant a tremendous shift in not only the type of food that we consume, but also how that food needs to be packaged. And that was one of the biggest challenges we dealt with this spring and summer as we worked through the COVID-19 pandemic on the ag side. In fact, when you think about, for example, our meat markets, it wasn't a challenge that we didn't have enough meat to meet demand. Sorry for using meat so many times there. But the idea is when you look at our meat supplies, they were ample enough to fulfill not only U.S. demand, but export demand as well. The problem was the meat supplies that we had were not packaged for at-home consumption. Most of it was being packaged and, if you will, distributed out towards away from home consumption, and especially, again, restaurants and the school districts. As we moved back away from that, then it was a case of, can we get it repackaged in a short amount of time? And that turned out to be quite challenging. And so we've got that worry as well, is that we continue to see shifts in food consumption patterns that can overwhelm the logistics that we have within our food supply chain. But when we added all this up and the United Nations World Food Program looked and said, we could see a doubling around the world of those that are going through acute food insecurity. Now, what is terrible about that is a doubling of the number, but I do want to point out that when they're talking about acute food insecurity, that when you looked at where we had gotten that number down below 200 million people throughout the world, which is, to me, actually quite impressive given there were 7 billion people on the planet. But it is challenging to see that COVID-19 could reverse a lot of the gains that we have seen in food distribution over the past decade. And again, I'll walk us through some data to show what the World Bank is referring to there. I do also want to point out, though, that, like I say, I think these are issues that we'll continue to face within global agriculture as we look out over the next couple of years, even if a COVID vaccine is coming forward in very soon. Because when you're looking at these changes, and especially the ripple effect of the loss in the general economy globally, those income losses will continue sort of to accumulate for the next couple of years. So it's likely that while agriculture has, again, come through the first wave of COVID-19 relatively fine, we will continue to see major challenges for the next couple of years. So starting off with what, you know, what the World Bank led off with, when we're looking at the production side of our agricultural and food markets, again, what we continue to see is very strong production. So this is looking at world wheat production. USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, updates these numbers on a monthly basis. And they rely upon a sub-agency within USDA known as the Foreign Agricultural Service, where they have offices in over, I believe it's 190 countries now, where they have people in the country on the ground that help us keep track of not only our production here in the U.S., but production worldwide. And when we look at the 2020 growing season, while we've had some challenges globally, and especially locally here in Iowa, as we dealt with drought and derecho, when we look overall, what we tend to see is U.S. production was impacted somewhat. As you can see here, the U.S. number dropped about 3 million tons this year compared to last year. But when we look overall across the globe, what we see is more production going on. In fact, overall worldwide, you're talking about nearly a 10 million ton gain in wheat production this year. Now, a lot of that is coming from the European Union. They're the major wheat exporter when you're looking worldwide. But you're also seeing China, India, they've always been very strong in producing their stable food crops, and they continue to see production increases there. So as the World Bank noted, when we're looking at production, we do see some very strong numbers out there. Situation for wheat, again, very strong. When we're looking at the world rice situation, we're basically talking about record production this year in 2020. The U.S., we're a very small component of that market. Again, China and India tend to be the largest producers. And because in this case, I would say both these countries, China and India, when you look at their production agriculture, they have dedicated a significant amount to make sure that they are as close to self-sustaining as they can be in certain staple foods. And rice and wheat would be the two main crops where both countries try to be as self-sufficient as possible. And for the most part, they are. They tend to be small importers or exporters in both these commodities. But as you're looking globally here, like I say, what this shows is the production side of agriculture fared through 2020 quite well. In fact, when I'm looking at the corn market globally, we're looking at record production again here in the U.S. The idea is even with the problems that we had with the drought and the derecho this year, we're still looking at very strong production this year, in fact, higher than we had last year. And we continue to see South America, again, coming through very strong, seeing increases in production there. So supply side, things are going real well. Here's soybeans as well. Same sort of pattern there where we've got, you know, record production around the world. So when we're looking at COVID-19 impacts here, especially on the crop side, you don't see the challenges. There was a little bit of worry on the meat side. And what we're seeing on the meat side is that, no, we were able to manage through. In fact, when I'm looking at meat, probably the bigger indication is how much trade we're seeing there. So I'm going to sort of shift from production to look at global trade. And I'll start with soybeans, but I'm going to jump to pork here in just a moment to show you that what we're seeing on the trade side is that we're seeing an increase actually in the amount of calories moving throughout the globe right now. In fact, in the soybean market, we're basically seeing double the export activity that we saw at this time last year. And so that's indicating at least robust agricultural markets and robust trade in those. So where countries have struggled in maybe trading other non-agricultural products, we're not seeing that struggle when it comes to agriculture, and especially when it comes in terms of meat and protein. This is the pork market, and looking at this, the red line represents our export sales so far this year, and I'm showing you the last 5 years just to sort of show the jump that we've seen in global trade in protein, especially since the pandemic began. And in fact, beginning a bit before that, some of this was driven by another disease outbreak, in this case, African swine fever in China. And the impact of that virus is still being felt by China as well. And so you can think of it, we've got two virus epidemics here hitting this market at the same time, yet we still see robust trade. And in fact, we're looking at globally record trade levels as we look at the proteins across the board, whether we're talking plant protein or animal protein looking forward here. And the idea is this expansion in protein trade seems to be fairly widespread when we look across countries. It isn't just driven by a China or an India. We are seeing smaller countries definitely make strong moves in moving protein in and out of their own countries. And so, as the World Bank sort of said, when we're looking right now, the agricultural markets have fared fairly well. We see very strong supplies. We see very strong global activity. And that combination has led to some significant rebound in agricultural prices, especially as we went through the last couple of months. Now, in this case, this is showing you the futures market prices for corn. And the reason I use the U.S. futures market is because since the U.S. is such a large agricultural producer, our prices do tend to, if you will, reflect the global price for those commodities. And what we saw in the corn market, and we're going to see this in several agricultural markets, is that as the pandemic wrapped around the globe, as it moved through the U.S., we did definitely see prices across the board that were pulled down because of concerns about the pandemic and the concerns of what it would mean, not only in terms of agricultural supplies, as we had the problems at the processing plants, but also in terms of that global demand, as we saw incomes work their way down. Now, as you can see here, for the corn market, the drops started basically at the beginning of the year. We found a low point around the 1st of May, saw some brief recovery in the summertime, hit down another low around the 1st of August. But since the 1st of August, we've seen those prices really rebound. And again, that's going to be sort of a scenario that we've seen across the board within agriculture. And a lot of this rebound in the second half of the year links back to that idea of robust trade. That, like I say, even with all the problems that we see out there, we continue to see the agricultural markets are very strong in terms of that business is still out there, the product is still moving, and that agricultural producers globally are enjoying better prices here in the second half of 2020. The same was sort of true for soybeans. In fact, what's unique about soybeans in comparison to a lot of other crops is that we actually now see prices higher than they were before the pandemic hit. And a lot of this, and I'd say especially here, this goes back to showing that strength in the global protein market. So when we're thinking about protein, again, oftentimes we think just meat, but I want you to think about plant proteins as well, and especially when you're talking oil seeds like soybeans or canola or rapeseed, those can be crushed And the meal that's left over is a very high valued protein source that can be utilized for both human and animal consumption. And so that need for that protein has really driven prices significantly higher over the past couple of months, leading to, if you will, even more of a rebound and recovery in some markets that exceeded where the markets were before the pandemic really hit. When we're looking at the livestock side of the market, the meat side of the market, you see that same sort of trend again, where prices were declining through the first half of the year. We saw sort of a bit of a recovery in the summer, but going back down again until about August. And I think August was really the period of time when the global ag markets had some, had a chance, if you will, to catch their breath from all the events of COVID-19 and actually sit and look and see, okay, what challenges had been met? Where do we still find problems out there? And what seems to have recovered more? And like I say, when we're looking at the vast majority of agricultural markets, what we found was that production was still in very good stead, that global demand through the trade figure was showing us that global demand was still there, and in fact was stronger than we may have originally thought, given the pandemic and how it has hit. So as we look here at the lean hog market, for example, we've seen significant recovery over the past couple of months. And this recovery is sort of counter-cyclical, if you will. Usually in agricultural markets, what we tend to see is our highest prices in the late spring and early summer. And as we approach the harvest season here and going into the holiday season, we tend to see lower prices then, because that's when we tend to have our largest supplies, but also that's when our demand tends to pull back a bit for most of our staple commodities here. 2020 is a year of opposites in that respect, where we saw the lows hitting where the highs usually are in terms of prices. And now that we're entering the period of time when we tend to see low prices, this is when we're trending to see our recovery. And that was happening in the cattle market even as well there. And in fact, the cattle market is the one that I'm watching most closely as we move forward, especially into 2021 and 2022. Because as we think about concerns about global income, one of the first things we see customers around the world do as far as managing their food budgets when they're facing a tighter income is we tend to trade down on the proteins. And so that means moving, if you will, down the line from usually it's beef, pork, and then we think about poultry. And so when you start to see the beef trade backing down or decreasing here, that's usually a sign about, okay, we're seeing that income shift, people moving to trade down the line on the protein side. And again, right now, when I'm looking at the agricultural trade markets, we're actually sort of seeing the opposite. We continue to see building strength right now in the beef market globally, building strength in the pork market and in the poultry market. So right now, protein demand is very strong, and the income issues that we're worried about, at least so far, haven't manifest themselves as we look at the global data. But it is something that we definitely worry about, because when we look at the general economy around the world, we do see a significant pullback. Fairly consistent about this economic downturn is that it is very similar in its spread as the last downturn we experienced back with the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, where we're tending to see our biggest cutback economically in our more advanced economies. And so when you're looking at our developing countries, our emerging markets, we're seeing a much smaller economic loss there, and that is helping support some of the agricultural trade that we're seeing, some of the agricultural demand that we're seeing, that those developing countries, they're facing a smaller income crunch than what we're seeing here in more developed parts of the world. And it's not just in terms of that development, but I want you to think about the idea that this is an indication not of just income, but of income potential as we move forward. since those developing economies have been growing at a much quicker pace, those are the markets that really do have a tremendous impact when we're looking at global demand for agricultural products. I believe when I've talked to this group before, we've chatted a bit about a rule that actually that I got from the World Bank about 20, 25 years ago that said when you're looking at significant shifts in food consumption patterns worldwide, the key feature was looking at income and looking at how they use that income, and specifically thinking about how much the average individual spends on food in a day. And the magic number that they told me back 30 years ago was basically $2 a day. That if you're looking at a country where the average spending was, you know, less than $2 a day on food, what you were tended to see was subsistence agriculture, and you tended to see a lot of the protein demand being met by plant materials. So that would be your soybeans or beans, things such as that. As the countries developed and gained more income, and once we saw that income rise enough that people could use more than $2 a day on their food spending, then you tended to see the shift over into the utilization of more meats. You tended to see an increase in the number and type of fruit and vegetables that were going into that country. And so you tended to see a broad growth in the change of, let's call it, the importing of food to meet the general populace's needs in that. And so when we're looking here, the idea is what we're still seeing is while those developing countries are shrinking right now in terms of their economy, they're not shrinking as much. That's giving them more opportunity to rebound, hopefully quickly, and continue to support agriculture. Now, in looking at where we're seeing those struggles, the idea is that we continue to see globally here that, again, COVID-19 was not just a physiological pandemic here, but it had true economic consequences throughout the globe. And in fact, as you look at most of the GDP data from around the world, most countries are staring at least an economic downturn, if not outright recession. But we do see some parts of the world that are still growing and growing fairly significantly. In fact, as you look at, you know, China, we're still projecting positive economic growth there. Spilling down into Southeast Asia, you can see there's been, you know, if you will, smaller losses as we look across most of Africa. And in fact, you still see some areas within the Central African core where we do see continued positive economic growth there. So I would say that the biggest areas where we are worried right now about food insecurity building would be places like South Asia, thinking specifically here about India, looking at sub-Saharan Africa, but especially very southern Africa as being a challenge, and then along the Mediterranean coast in North Africa as well, and then Latin America, not an area that we've concentrated on, I think, recently in terms of concerns about economic activity and especially agricultural needs, but it is an area to watch that even though South America does produce a lot of agricultural products, they're still finding it very challenging in some cases to meet their own needs. And so when we're looking at, you know, this, it's a combination of worried about not just the income that they have, but also the prices that their consumers face. And so I also wanted to map out for you at least what we're seeing right now in terms of inflation around the world. And here you can see that especially as we look at Africa and Asia, we do see some significant overall inflation. Now, some of this would be, a lot of this actually is outside of agriculture because we don't have for all these individual countries a split between agricultural inflation and non-agricultural inflation. But we do know that as we look at, and again, I'll concentrate on certain areas, South Asia, down there in Southern Africa, and what we're starting to see in Central South America, we are starting to see that food inflation pressure build up in those areas. So that's the sort of concern we've got going forward here, is that it's not necessarily that the virus itself is creating problems, but the problems come with it in that the virus has limited the economic activity of these countries. It has dropped the income levels for the people in those countries. And at the same time, too, we're seeing certain countries have retail food price pressure, even though global supplies of food products remain very robust right now. And so when you look at the overall picture, and this is, I'm going to say, the punchline as I look at what the World Bank was staring at there, is what we had been seeing over the past several years had been enough global economic activity that we were seeing a drop in the number of individuals who were considered in extreme poverty, a drop in the number of individuals worldwide where we're seeing that acute food insecurity. So in this case, this is a graph that the World Bank provides data for that looks at extreme poverty throughout the globe. What it measures here, I'll read a little bit here. It says the number of poor in millions on the left-hand axis, and it plots the data from 2015 out through 2021. Now, in this case, given that it's a global measure and it takes a while to gather all the information from the various countries throughout the world, the latest, if you will, hard number where we have firm data would be for the year 2017. So the rest of this is based upon the growth rates that we've estimated for various countries throughout the world. We continue to project forward how those levels of extreme poverty have changed. And the idea is, as we start here, you know, in 2015, you're talking about over 700 million individuals worldwide were considered in extreme poverty. As we get to 2019, the projection, so just before, if you will, COVID hit, we were looking at having that number have dropped by nearly 100 million folks. And so we had seen more income growth worldwide, and that was helping lift people out of poverty and hopefully, and should have been, improving their nutritional state. COVID-19 hits here in 2020, and you can see that in this case, the World Bank has provided two projections as we move forward here, 2020 and 2021. The blue line represents what I would call their consensus forecast, their average forecast looking forward for this year and next year. The orange line sort of shows, let's call it a worst case scenario, not the worst case, but a worst case scenario, where we see larger drops in agricultural or economic activity worldwide. And so what you see here is a growth in that number of folks that are in extreme poverty by anywhere from 60 to 80 million people just within this past year. And the vast majority of that we can link to COVID-19. And as we're looking forward into next year, as you can see here, the idea is they're saying that we will likely continue to see that problem maybe stabilize, but likely build at least a little bit as we move into 2021. So that's why I say ag is in a relatively decent position right now when we're looking from the global perspective. But there are reasons for some concern as we look out there, and it's mostly driven by factors within the general economy, not necessarily specific to just agriculture as we look. Now, I recognize, actually, I went through this fairly quickly, and I wanted to do that because I know in working with this group before, this group is very good about asking questions that I always appreciate. And so with this, I'm going to sort of turn it back to Megan a little early so that we can begin the Q&A and hopefully have a few more questions getting answered.
Sure, absolutely. I think you're right. We usually do have great questions for you. All right, let's see here. So before we move into questions, while I give you guys a little bit of time to think about what you might want to ask, I am going to remind you about our upcoming programs. So we have a program next week on Thursday, October 22nd, and that is going to be by Elizabeth Bernal and Nicole Novak of the Johnson County Chapter of the United Nations Association. And they're going to be speaking to us on promoting health and well-being and reducing inequalities in Iowa. Immigration policy, stress, and community health are the topics for that. That is also a celebration of UNA Day, which also happens next week. So it'll be an exciting little special feature. The week after that, on Wednesday, we have Nick Grossman, who is formerly of the University of Iowa, but is now a professor of political science at the University of Illinois. And he is going to be speaking to us on Russian electoral interference and 21st century information warfare. So that will be a very interesting topic as well, and very timely with the election coming up shortly thereafter. So with that, let's see if we have any questions. I'm not seeing any popping up in my chat yet. Do you have anything sent directly to you, Chad?
Does not look like it. So my chat box is clear. Oh, okay. Here we go. Oh,
perfect. Okay. So we usually, I'll just read it out loud just in case someone is calling in so everyone can hear it, and then turn it over to you. So we have a question from Peter. Is the recent uptick in commodity prices perhaps responsible for the continued Iowa farmer support for President Trump?
I would say it does contribute partially to that. But when you think about the farmer community and their political leanings, farmers do tend to be very conservative. And, you know, throughout this entire, not even, you know, COVID-19, thinking about the issues with the U.S.-China trade dispute that we went through and the low commodity prices that we've experienced over the past few years, farmer support for President Trump has held fairly firm through all of that. This recent uptick in prices may enhance that a little bit, but for the most part, I would say that, you know, whether prices are up or down for in the ag commodities has very little movement on how farmers actually vote.
Okay, good to know. So Dave asks, thank you, Chad, for a wonderful presentation. And can you comment on our trade war with China? Has ag exports to China recovered or increased?
The answer is we have seen some recovery there. So within the trade war, we did see, if you will, a truce that was signed earlier this year, known as the Phase One trade deal. Within that, there's been a lot of speculation as to what we would see in terms of not only ag trade, but overall global trade there. And what we have seen is a significant increase in sales to China this year versus the last couple of years. Especially, I showed that soybean export slide early in my talk. And when you think about soybeans, China is our major market for that. Before the trade war started, China took 60% of U.S. soybean exports. Right now, as I look at the data so far this year, they're back around 60%. So we've seen a strong recovery in that relationship, at least on the agricultural side.
Okay, great. That's great to hear. So I don't see any questions just yet, so I'll add one of my own. So you showed the slide, which I found very interesting, of the projection of poverty increase due to COVID-19. Do you see any other long-term lasting effects on the agricultural side of things from the COVID pandemic?
I think that's the other issue here is I'm looking for long-lasting impacts. Probably the biggest one I'm looking at may be in the meat industry. And again, links back to what we just experienced with COVID-19. What we found was that while our meat processing facilities, they had been really designed for, let's call it, efficient processing of animals to reach consumers in a cost-effective manner. Very efficient at doing that. But it is also those processing plants turned out to be very efficient in terms of virus spread through the worker households there. I think you will see some permanent changes in the way that we build and process animals. And it's not just the meat industry that faced this. In fact, for example, I recently had my furnace go out in my house and I had to buy a new furnace. And in talking with the local heating and air conditioning guys, they were like, yeah, you saw the same production problems hit in those larger appliance factories that we look here. So it's not just the meat processing that is unique there. We saw that anywhere where we're having these large factories that are built for, let's call it, cost efficient production practices.
Sure. And just a quick follow-up to that. Do you see any of those changes like specific to here in Iowa? Because I know there's been a lot of press about, for example, the Tyson meat plants here in Iowa. So,
So you're seeing Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride. There's a lot of the, let's call them the large processing companies, definitely looking at making changes in their lines. But I would say what you're seeing also here in Iowa is you're seeing what's called a resurgence of sort of that local meat processing. So this sort of goes along with, and I think we talked about this in a previous session with this group, movements towards local foods, locally sourced. And so a rebound in that. It used to be that every small town in Iowa had its own individual meat locker, and those have disappeared over time. Well, you're starting to see some of those come back. And so I think we will see more distributed meat production, even here in the state of Iowa.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, so Dave actually has a follow-up to his question about the trade war. So he's asking, Brazil is our primary competitor in soybean exports. Are they still expanding their soybean production?
They definitely are. Again, if you go back and look at that soybean table, actually Brazil, within the past couple of years, has passed the U.S. to become the largest producer of soybeans in the world, and they are a very strong exporter. And so when you're thinking about especially that Chinese market, it is basically dominated by U.S. and Brazilian soybeans. And so we're in direct competition there, but so far the competition has been, I guess I'll call it friendly, in that both markets, both the U.S. and the Brazilian markets, are seeing growth this year.
Okay, great. So Peter, he's following up again on the meat packing plant. So he's asking for you to comment on the fact that increased efficiency of our meat packers ignores the externalities, including the health of our workers.
I would agree with that. Definitely. That was the case. And like I say, that's what created the situation that we saw. The processing was set up for that efficiency to create the meat, but it also created an efficiency that is the externality here. The health of the workers was jeopardized because they were put in such close quarters. Because, you know, in this case, I would say this is the issue of trying to learn how to deal with the pandemic in the modern age when we haven't faced anything like this in probably 100 years.
Sure. To me, it seems like another example of the new normal that everyone's talking about. Industrialization going forward is going to have that new normal as well then. In terms of their
It's industrialization, but it's also, let's just call it life. I mean, as we sit here today, we're meeting in a brand new way. Why? It's not that, you know, our meetings created that same type of issue. Humans were very social animals. And if you will, what COVID-19 and what any sort of pandemic takes advantage of is oftentimes that need for us to be social, whether it's at work, at school, or at play. And it takes advantage of any opportunity it can. And it definitely found one within our work systems, not only in meat packing, but I would argue in a lot of our industrial base.
Absolutely. Okay, so I see no more yet. So I'm gonna add another one of my own since we still have time. And you've kind of touched on it already, of course, but with the election coming up, I think people are very interested in the impacts of almost everything on the upcoming politics and the upcoming election. And so I was wondering like what you would have to say about like just agriculture's impact in general and the impact that like the current situation is having on what we see happening politically as well.
Well, I think what you see politically and you know, it sort of comes down to think of the events of just last night. We saw the president of the United States fly into Des Moines, Iowa to have a rally and then fly out. That shows, I would say, concern on the president's part that Iowa is in play, that even though we are a large agricultural state with that conservative farmer base, that Iowa is still a swing state, if you will, that, you know, just, you know, trying to manage the farmer base is not enough in order to hold on to the election. And so I think what you're seeing here is now a president that recognizes that he's got to battle for every vote that he can get out there. You see a challenge with former Vice President Biden, who's working that, I would say, the swing ground that we have. Because when I look at Iowa, I always describe it as, it's always a contest between the 15 most populous counties in this state versus the 84 rural counties. And typically it comes down to, you know, six or seven counties that tend to be sort of the, if you will, the suburb counties that really move how the election's going to go. And I think that's where both the president and the former vice president are trying to reach into those suburban counties.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely seen that myself. I grew up in Northwest Iowa, and I was actually just home to visit family this last weekend. And you really do see the shift going from a place like Iowa City up to Northwest Iowa of just the yard signs are a big sign. But yeah, absolutely. I think the farming community has a lot to do with that. So that's very interesting. So I don't see any more questions. I don't know if, has anyone sent any to you privately?
No.
No. Okay. So, oh, good. Well, we have one from Dave now. So he is asking, can you comment on the wheat production in Ukraine?
Sure. And bear with me, Dave. So bear with me, Megan. I'm going to go back.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I can pull that up directly here. So when we're looking at wheat, oops, I don't know why it went back to there, but we'll just go this way. So, you know, David mentioned Ukraine. What we are seeing there is a drop in production. We are seeing some weather problems, especially as we look at the Black Sea region. It does tend to be a strong production area. In fact, when you think about global production of agricultural products, I think I've made a joke before that there are three big hot spots worldwide where you're going to see a lot of agricultural production: Central U.S., Black Sea region, and then South America. And they tend to concentrate on three big crops. The Black Sea region, the concentration tends to be on wheat. And what we're seeing there right now is you'll notice Ukraine down, but Russia up. So the idea is the Black Sea region as a whole is producing more wheat, but we are seeing some struggles, especially in Western to Central Ukraine, where they've had some production problems pulling that production down. Another thing's also happening in Ukraine is that as we're seeing wheat have problems there, I think the numbers here in corn, if you look at the corn production here, you'll notice it's going up. Another things at play in Ukraine, we are seeing a shift in the crop base being produced by different countries. And we have seen more corn and soybean production moving into the Black Sea region at the expense of wheat.
Very interesting. Okay. I'm not seeing anything more. We have plenty of time left. If anyone has any last minute questions they want to throw in, Chad, if you have any last minute comments you'd like to make.
Well, I think when you're looking at this, and like I say, the challenge to me is one, you ask about COVID-19. I remember when the quest first came in, and it's one of these deals of, we'll never know the full answer until it's over, and it's still not over. And we know we're in the midst still of this pandemic. Two, when I'm looking at agriculture, like I say, it's survived this first wave, and we figured out where the pinch points are, but we probably still don't know all the ramifications of what's happening out here on the globe. And like I say, figuring out how life is really going to change. I didn't bring this up in the presentation as much, and I probably should have, but when you think about, for example, our school system, this was really big as far as the milk industry was concerned. Because when you think about fluid milk consumption, what really drives that is having students at their schools drinking out of those little cardboard containers. It's amazing how much milk moves that way. When the school system shut down, that forced a tremendous problem on the milk industry, because basically they went from trying to, you know, they had all these cardboard containers built for the school systems. Now they're suddenly trying to figure out where they can get more plastic jugs to get it to the retail marketplace. And so again, it wasn't a problem of we were running out of milk. No, we had plenty of milk. What we didn't have was enough milk packaging. of the appropriate type to reach where the customers were at that point. With that, I saw a question come in. So
yes, I saw that too. So Ken is asking, what is the future of industrial agriculture?
Well, that's the deal. I think when you're looking long term here, you're going to see agriculture, I think, let's call it divide, as I think it's doing now. You're still going to see large scale industrial production of a fair number of commodities. But what you're also seeing is a building movement within not only agricultural production, but really being driven by consumers as far as more, let's call it, stylized agricultural production to meet some individual needs. So when we're looking at our local foods movement, our farmers markets, those aren't just fads that I think are going to go away. I think those are long-term movements that are creating change, but it's change at a local or regional level. There are some products that just don't fit that niche. And I'm going to argue, for example, like corn doesn't. Corn's a commodity where it lends itself to the industrial process. But I think in certain cases, when you're looking especially at your fruits, your vegetables, and in fact, some meats even, because people, when we're shopping for meat now, especially here in the developed world, people aren't just shopping for protein, but we're looking for other attributes that come with that food product. We want to feel that that food product is represents our way of life or way that we want to look at life. And so that does have an influence that consumers can drive change in the production practice. So like I say, is there a future in industrial ag? I'm going to argue yes, but it's not the enveloping industrial ag across every product, across every commodity here that you will see more stylized agriculture in the future.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating to see the shift back to more of a local production standpoint. It's definitely a different direction than we've gone in the past.
It is. It's a different one. I know my parents actually ran a little locker plant in Southwest Missouri. And so I grew up in one of the, one of those little mom and pop organizations, and it's interesting to see it come back again.
Yeah,
because I know it can be a rewarding career, and I know how hard a career it is. And so it takes somebody with dedication in order to do that. I think that's a lot of it when we're looking at, especially at local foods efforts. It takes people that are dedicated to that production idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I know here in Iowa City, actually just down the street from me, since the pandemic started, we've actually seen a meat store primarily just sells meat open up. Not in a business district, and it seems to be doing really, really well. And that I found that very interesting. So that's great, though. So I did just have a question sent to me privately. So the question is, what are the developments and partnerships taking place with respect to agriculture and other industries, such as engineering and technology?
Oh, you're seeing a tremendous number of interactions that way. One of my favorite ones that I've heard thus far is this idea of putting little, for lack of a better term, they're almost like little stickers on the plants in order to help optimize our ability to grow and, create the conditions for those plants to reach full potential. So in this case, what I want you to think of is when you think about our corn and soybeans plants throughout the countryside, the idea of being able to put a little sticker on each of them so that we know if they are receiving the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium that they're needing, are they needing a little water or not? And so that we can, if you will, stylize the nutrient diet to those plants to make sure that we are reaching potential, but also not wasting those nutrients, not creating, the word that was brought up. And I love that Peter used the word externalities in a question. It's not often that I get that. but the idea of, trying to avoid some of the negative externalities that we've had within production agriculture over the past century.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's very interesting, trying to individualize the approach to growing.
to me, it's hard to think about the idea of, you know, just putting something on the surface of the plant, having it be able to tell you that, but then, you know, getting that information out. So it's to me, it's a tremendous technology question.
Absolutely.
It raises up some interesting ideas about that you can manage at that scale within a farm.
Absolutely.
In large scale on a farm that way.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. Another example of big data and kind of what that can mean for the future of industries and things. So a follow-up question from that I also received privately was, just in general, what are you most excited about looking forward in agriculture globally?
I think globally it's, I'm always interested and amazed in the ability of global farmers to meet the needs of, within their local demand. For example, we think about Africa, and I think that it's, you know, not very developed, that, you know, that they're an area that imports a lot of things within agriculture. But when you look at the African continent, you know, the agriculture producers there produce, I believe it's 92% of all the calories that are needed on the continent. So that even with what we would consider fairly primitive agricultural production practices, they do a tremendous job in meeting local needs. And that also shows their ability to meet future needs as we're going forward. And to me, that is very exciting because, you know, the worry has always been we're at 7 billion people now. We're supposed to be about 9 billion people by 2050. How are we going to keep up with the need for nutrition on this planet? And the idea is I look at a, you know, continent like Africa, and you can see the potential to not only meet those needs, but possibly exceed those needs. And we could see Africa being, you know, again, I'm looking at this from an ag economist, they could become a bigger competitor to us in terms of the global marketplace if they can develop their agricultural processes.
Wow. Yeah, that would be a very exciting future for sure. Okay. Well, I don't see anything else come in, and we're much closer to the time to end now, so this looks good. I just want to give you a huge thank you for coming back and presenting to us again. I know global agriculture is a topic that's very near and dear to all of us here in Iowa, so thank you very much for that. And I would also like to thank our members and sponsors and interns for the support and all the hard work that they put into making these programs possible. And to conclude, Chad, I would like to present you with what I believe will be your second coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council mug.
I've got three of them. This will be the third.
Wow, you should start just a collection shelf, I think.
Well, I can bring them out, you know, at one party, everybody gets a mug.
Perfect. I was just thinking maybe we should start producing a slightly larger one for each succession. I love it. Perfect. All right. Well, we will get that to you in the mail soon. And thank you again for joining us. And for everyone watching, thank you for joining us. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.